Erev Tov, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome Rav Avayet Tabori again. We haven't had him for a few months, and I really want to give him a big yasher koach. It's 3:30 in the morning in Israel, but he wanted to get up. I don't know if he was planning to be in America or got stuff. He didn't answer me with that question. If he was originally planning to be here, which is why he picked this week, recruiting for yeshivas, a lot of people, obviously that all got canceled. But so I want to give him a big yasher koach. Rav Tabori. It teaches full time at Yeshivat Eretz Hatzvi. He teaches Talmud and is the head of their halachic department. He studied in Or Etzion and Yeshivat Har Etzion to a degree in Jewish education from Herzog. He served as a shliach Me'akiva in the UK and has been at Camp Stone for many years. He serves as Rosh Beit Midrash 1 month every year in Camp Stone when my kids have had the pleasure of being there with him. And of course, Rav Tabori spent his pre-formative years in Toronto, where when he was a little kid, but his father, Alav HaShalom, was Rav Binyamin Tabori, of course, was my Rosh Yeshiva for the 4 years that he was there. His 4 years in Toronto, my 4 years in high school coincided before he went to become a Rav in Yeshiva at Har Etzion, and he's following in his father's footstep, Rav Avayet, and it's a pleasure, and we'll let you speak, and I hope the tea is as good as the coffee. Vakasha.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you, Erev Tov, everyone. It's wonderful to be back here. And I just hope that at some point we can get back to really visiting and not just being on Zoom. This week's Parsha, Parshat Shmot, begins a new book. With it, a new story about Am Yisrael living in Egypt and the redemption, Geulat Mitzrayim. On the source sheet that I sent out, you don't have to look at it, but I brought down at the source number one this wonderful midrash that actually appears in Vayikra Rabbah, not in Shmot. It's a well-known midrash. In fact, it's such a well-known midrash that I find that many times when I quote it, people are so sure that the real quote is not what it says in the midrash. The midrash tells us, "Bishvil arba'a dvarim nigalu Yisrael mimitzrayim." The midrash, I would say, even asks a question. What is the merit of the Jewish people when they were living in Egypt? And the question of the Midrash, the discussion of the Midrash, is based upon the idea that Judaism is mostly built upon keeping Torah mitzvot. And the Midrash is as if asking, why did God say the Jewish people, what was their merit? In other words, what kept them together as a people? What made them unique, special, different? You know, many years ago, I read an article of Professor Yishai Leibovitz. Yishai Leibovitz is a well-known philosopher of Jewish philosophy and a man of great thought. But he was very provocative, and I remember, you know, sometimes reading his words or his works were not always considered to be, such a done thing in our circles. And he has a wonderful article in which he makes a good argument that what makes the Jewish people, what made us remain the Jewish people for over 2,000 years was the Torah. If people kept the Torah, if people kept mitzvot, if people kept Shabbat and Kashrut, that meant they were Jewish. And if they didn't, they were out of the community and they assimilated. It was very simple. Either you kept Torah and mitzvot, or you were out of the community. And that was the main or only Jewish identity that people had for thousands of years. And yet this midrash may seem to argue with this idea. This midrash suggests that even before the Torah was given, before there were mitzvot, there are certain behavior patterns, characteristics, perhaps culture behavior patterns that Am Yisrael kept, which made them Jewish, which defined them as part of the Jewish family. And the midrash lists four characteristics or four behavior patterns that Am Yisrael kept before the Torah was given. The first one was shelo shinu et shmam, that they didn't change their name. I will share my the source sheet. Here we go. Okay, if you can see, thank you. Echad shelo shinu et shmam. The Midrash tells us that they kept their Jewish names. The Midrash says ve'ed leshonam. They kept the Hebrew language. They all spoke Hebrew. Three, lo amru lashon hara. They didn't speak lashon hara. Isn't that beautiful, amazing, right? Before the Torah was given in a natural way, there was no need to tell them, but there was a feeling of unity. People were nice to each other. They didn't speak evil on one on the other. And the last attribute of Am Yisrael was lo nimtza b'nem echad men parutz be'erva. In matters of sexual misconduct, Am Yisrael kept a certain standard of modesty when it came to who they married and how they were in their sexual conduct. So the Midrash basically tells us that these four attributes existed in the Jewish people because of these behaviors of the Jewish people. God redeemed the Jewish people. Like, and as I said before, I think this Midrash is a very powerful one because it suggests that there is a value to the way we behave, the way we act, not necessarily only in the world of Torah mitzvot, but that there are other important ideas that define who we are and are important for the existence of the Jewish people. I'll get back to that in a few minutes. However, this Midrash has in addition to it, if you look in source number 2, you will see that some people are convinced that the original Midrash actually is a little bit different, and the Ritva actually has a different girsa, has a different reading in the Midrash. V'chen yesh gorsim shehem nikarim b'malbusheihem. The Ritva tells us that there's a fifth, perhaps a fifth, or maybe a fourth, maybe he takes one of the list out, and he mentions that Am Yisrael were also unique and special in the fact that they all wore Jewish clothes. I guess it means they wore shtreimels in Egypt and blacks. I don't know, maybe black kapotas suits. I don't know what exactly were the Jewish clothes in Egypt. But apparently, even thousands of years ago, Jews in Egypt were known by their clothes. So again, you see that not everything is necessarily about keeping the law, but rather certain cultural behaviors are also important for the definition of the Jewish people. The Midrash even gives us examples. If you go back to the first Midrash, it tells us, Lo shinu et shmam Reuven veShimon. They kept the names Reuven and Shimon. Nachatin Reuven veShimon, they went down to Egypt with the names Reuven Shimon veSalkin, and they went up to Eretz Israel with the names of Reuven Shimon. Lo ayu korim liYuda Rufa veLo leReuven Lulani. They didn't have nicknames. They didn't change their names to what we would call non-Jewish names. VeLo leYosef Listis. Now this is fascinating. Velo Libyamin Alexandri. I find that fascinating because Alexander is a very well-known Jewish name. Which I want to pause a second and ask ourselves a second, what makes a Jewish name a Jewish name? Right? I'm going to go off a second. Right? If a person's name is Zelig, right? Is Zelig a Jewish name? We have Heti and so many different Yiddish names. Alexander is a well-known Jewish name, even though it doesn't start and begin in the Jewish community. What makes a Jewish name a Jewish name? So on your source sheet, I'm not going to go through every word because it's, I'm sorry, I didn't translate the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein. But on source number 7, you can see that Rav Moshe Feinstein I'm sorry, that's about clothes. One second. Source number eight. Yes, source number eight. Let me just see a second. Oh, no, I was right. Source number seven. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked whether or not a person is allowed to call their child a non-Jewish name. Apparently, Rav Moshe, I'll go back to the story sheet. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked many, many years ago about calling your name. This was Tashimim, 1980, not so long ago. Someone asked Rav Moshe Feinstein if he can call the daughter a Yiddish name, right? It's not even calling your daughter some non-Jewish name. It's a Yiddish name. And is a Yiddish name considered to be a non-Jewish name? Is that a problem? And Rav Moshe Feinstein even mentions our Midrash as some source that indicates that the common, you know, the correct common behavior of the Jewish people is to keep Jewish names. And he goes into this discussion. By the way, the name of this girl in the Tshuva, if you look at it's Gittel. You see the name? It's Gittel. You see Gittel? Right, so Gittel is a very well-known Jewish name. I can't believe that, you know, non-Jews are called Gittel. And the question is that considered a Jewish name? The Rav Moshe actually says something very interesting. He says, if you look at the names in the Talmud, you'll see there are people called Rav Papa, right? Rav Zvid, Zutra, and he brings all these names and nicknames. Abaye, we all know, Rava. These are not Jewish names. He brings Rishonim, like the Rambam's father, who was called Maimon. Maimon is not a Jewish name. Even Alexander, he mentions. And he goes on and says, wait a second, if we're going to start being so righteous and say that we only can call our kids Jewish names that appear in the Bible, then we are basically speaking ill about generations and generations of great, great sages of the Jewish people who also call themselves names that were common in their communities. And therefore, it's impossible to say, argued Rav Moshe, that you have to call your kid a biblical name. By the way, I just want to add, what makes a biblical name also a Hebrew name? You know, in Israel, it's very common today to call your kid Ma'ayan or Shachar or, you know, Na'al, Shulchan, Kisei, right? If you call your, I'm joking a little bit, but if you call your kid like, you know, Shulchan, a table, because a Hebrew word, does that make it a Hebrew name, right? What makes, it's an interesting question, which I don't have, you know, a definite answer to, but I'm not sure if using a word in Hebrew is necessarily automatically considered a Hebrew name. So it's a good question. So if all this is true, Rav Moshe asks if this is all true, that's not so important. And then Jewish history, Jews were not careful to only call their kids Jewish names. So why does our Midrash that we just quoted and put so much importance in the Jewish name? And if you follow me in his story sheet, I'm going to read and translate. He says, "V'neyesh makom domar dezeh sheshibchu chazal." There's room to argue that the fact that our rabbis gave praise to the Jews in Egypt, the Galut Mitzrayim, that they didn't change their names, it's because this was before the Torah was given. Said Rav Moshe, the significance of calling your kids a Jewish name that the Midrash mentions here as a great merit is referring to a specific generation in Jewish history in which there was nothing else. What else was there? What could a Jew do to make himself known as a Jew? In what way could he celebrate his Judaism? There was no tzitzit, there was no tefillin, there was no prayer, there was no hadlakat nerot, there was no Shabbat, there was no kashrut. What was there? How was a person known? How can he celebrate to others and to himself the fact that he was Jewish? Says Rav Moshe, that's what the Midrash is trying to tell us. That at that point, calling your kid a Jewish name had great value. So I think that idea of Rav Moshe is probably true not only about calling your kid a Jewish name, but perhaps it's true about the other ideas that are mentioned in this midrash. Let's go to the idea of wearing Jewish clothes. How important is it to wear Jewish clothes? Is it something that you would argue that exists today? Now, I'm sure when we talk about Jewish clothes, right? As I mentioned before, jokingly, I said, you know, wearing a shtreimel, wearing a black hat in many circles today is considered Jewish clothes. But I want to ask a similar question to the question I asked about Jewish names. Is there anything called Jewish clothes today? Is there any significance, any meaning in the idea of wearing Jewish clothes? So here again, there is a fascinating tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And here again, I will refer to our source sheet. We're going to go down here. In source number 9, Rav Moshe in Tavshin Yud Gimel, which is 1953, source number 9, he was asked if Jews coming to America from Poland are allowed to change their clothes from Polish Jewish clothes to American clothes. Now, I'm not exactly sure what he meant. I assume that he meant, can people take off their long black perhaps their black hats and shtreimels and wear jeans and t-shirts? I'm assuming that that's what he meant. Obviously, jeans, you can argue, is a very Jewish clothes. It was made by a Jew, Levi, right? Levi. Levi jeans was invented by the Jews. So I'm not sure exactly what he meant, but I guess the people in 1953 knew exactly what he's talking about whether or not you can change your Jewish clothes. So here Rav Moshe Feinstein goes into a whole new halachic category, which is Chukot HaGoyim. The Torah tells us that one is not allowed to behave in the manners of the non-Jews. And the question Rav Moshe discusses in his tshuva is whether or not there is a problem of wearing non-Jewish clothes. Because when a person, as if, is wearing non-Jewish clothes, he's trying to imitate the ways of the non-Jew. He's trying to assimilate with the non-Jew. Is that a problem of the prohibition of chukot hagoyim, of going into the, following the ways of the non-Jew? So in this context, he quotes the Maharik, I'm highlighting here. The Maharik was a late Rishon, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, who discussed whether or not a doctor is allowed to wear a doctor's cape. It's in his language, it's kappa. I guess it's a cape. I guess it's very similar to what we would use today, what a doctor today would use, some kind of cloak, white cloak that would distinguish him as a doctor. And the Maharik, hundreds of years ago, allowed the doctor, the Jewish doctor, to wear what they saw as, at the time, as some non-Jewish garments. And the reason he said it was permitted was because the reason to wear such a cloth, he said, had a benefit, right? And this, by the way, became a principle brought down in Shulchan Aruch, that any type of behavior that has in it a benefit for those doing it. For example, if I'm imitating the ways of the non-Jew, but I'm doing it for a purpose, for a reason. I'm not doing it because I want to assimilate or try to become like the non-Jew, but I'm doing it because I'm actually gaining something, there's a reason for doing it. The Maharik said it is permitted. I can tell you that here in Israel, there were huge discussions regarding, for example, performing military funerals for Israeli soldiers, right? Whether or not shooting in the air and doing the whole ceremony was considered imitating the ways of the non-Jew, and it would be permitted or not. And some people, again, discuss this Maharik, they discuss this idea whether or not saluting, shooting a rifle in the air at a funeral is considered a benefit? Is it considered a kavod, a matter of respect to the Israeli soldier that would be considered permitted? So there are a lot of examples where poskim use this discussion as a case study to allow and permit certain and customs that exist outside the Jewish community, whether or not they're permitted based upon these principles. However, going back to our discussion, the Maharik and Rav Moshe Feinstein permitted wearing clothes today that are not considered to be Jewish clothes. And what's interesting here is that if you go down a little bit, he says, and I'm highlighting it, the gam beloze en shayach isur malbush nochrim. He says, actually, I don't need the whole discussion of before to permit it. Why? The akimat kol bnei Yisrael lovshim malbushim elu. Meaning, he said, bottom line is, Jews today in the world are all dressing in modern clothes. There are no clothes today, he said, this is 1950, that distinguish Jews from non-Jews. The clothes that the world wears today are clothes that don't distinguish a people from another people, a nation from a nation, a community from a community. People wear clothes, they wear clothes. There's nothing in the clothes today that makes you Jewish or not Jewish. And therefore, he says, he concludes, Imken af elu shebao mipolin, all those who come from Poland to America, Rasha'in litlabesh bebegadim, you're allowed to wear clothes that are American clothes. Because, he says, here in America, there are no clothes that Jews wear differently than non-Jews, and therefore it is permitted. So, again, we can see that these ideas that perhaps existed in the time of Egypt do not necessarily bind us today in our lifestyle in our days. Nowadays, there is no real requirement to wear Jewish clothes. I will point out, by the way, please do not worry. We're going to go back to the parasha in a few minutes. This is all a background to try to understand this midrash. There is a fascinating article that I found of Reb Soloveitchik. I'll just show you in this book called Divrei Hashkafa. To my knowledge, this book was not translated to English. In this book of Reb Soloveitchik, he has an article in which he gives a sermon to the Jewish community of the 1950s, and you can hear his rebuke in this article, in this sermon that he delivered. In it, he talks against Jews of his time that are hiding the fact that they are Jewish. Rav Soloveitchik complains in this article that while he rides the subway in New York, that's what he says, I guess he did because that's what he says in the article, that he used to ride the subway, and he was disturbed to see how Jews used to hide their Jewish newspapers because they didn't want anyone to know that they were Jews. Now, this is a fascinating idea because I'm actually, when I spoke to my students about this, we mentioned that it is true that, unfortunately, many Jews today in the world and even in North America are starting to speak about how they need to hide their Judaism, perhaps for anti-Semitic reasons. I'm not going to go into this right now. I don't live in North America, so I'm not familiar so much about what's going on right now. But I think it's fair to say that just a few years ago, Jews were not hiding their Magen David or their Chai or their Kippah or whatever it was riding the subway because of anti-Semitic reasons. And perhaps if Jews were doing such a thing, Rabbi Soloveitchik was correct that they didn't feel comfortable of being identified as a Jew. And Rabbi Soloveitchik points out our midrash, and he actually discusses what we're discussing today. He mentions this midrash and says that Jews should be proud of who they are. They should walk around with their as if Jewish clothes of their generation. Meaning he takes this midrash and says there is something in this midrash that is true in every generation. I'm going to add, he doesn't say this, but I would say, right, your Magen David that you walk around on your necklace would be as if the Jewish clothes that the Midrash is referring to. So I think that's a very interesting idea that he talks about. I will say that halachically, he does argue that even in his days, there might be some idea of Jewish clothes and a prohibition to wear non-Jewish clothes. In what context? He says that if there are special clothes that identify you as part of a specific nation, then perhaps it would be prohibited for a Jew to wear those clothes. I think he even says that in our days, this doesn't exist anymore. But perhaps, let's say a kilt for a Scottish, right? For in Scotland, wearing a kilt would identify you as a Scotsman. Perhaps Rev Soloveitchik is saying that, you know, hundreds of years ago, for a Jew to wear a kilt would be questionable, right? If there are today, if you go to Holland and you wear wooden clogs, you do it for as a tourist just to take a picture. No one in Holland today wears wooden clogs. But perhaps wearing, you know, Dutch clothes 400 years ago for a Jew, Rav Soloveitchik would argue would be an issue. My father, Lava Shalom, many years ago, officiated at a wedding in England, and the Chatan, the Kala, asked him to be the Mesader Kiddushin, and my father agreed, and the Chatan came over to my Abba and said to him, Rabbi Tabori, I'm a Scotsman, and I would like to wear a kilt under my chuppah. And my father, those who know him, said, that's wonderful, I wish you luck, but just you'll have to find another rabbi, because there is no way I'm going to perform a wedding for a chatan wearing a kilt. So I'm saying, I don't know what bothered my father exactly, but Rav Soloveitchik really, really says that perhaps wearing specific clothes that are identifying you as a different nation would be a halachic problem. Nowadays, as Rav Moshe Feinstein says, there are no clothes that would be considered to be usser because they identify you as a non-Jew. Going back to the Midrash, the other principles that the Jews kept in Egypt, that they spoke Hebrew and that they didn't talk Lashon Hara, obviously has to do with language. I think that this idea of speaking Hebrew and speaking, not only speaking Hebrew, but speaking in the correct way, not using the language to speak Lashon Hara, is also a very interesting idea that I want to, before we go back to the Parsha, I would like to highlight this idea and ask, is there any real mitzvah or significance in speaking Hebrew? Is there any halacha that one should speak Hebrew? So interestingly enough, there are people that wrote about this and discussed this question and actually proved from certain sources, like the Rambam, that there might be a mitzvah to speak Hebrew. The Rambam, in his Perush HaMishnayos, in his commentary on the Mishnah, mentioned, he uses the word mitzvah when he talks about teaching your child Torah, teaching your child Hebrew. He mentions it as he would mention any other mitzvah. And many people have proved from this Rambam and other sources that perhaps speaking Hebrew per se, right? Not in the context of learning Torah, perhaps that is a mitzvah. My father, Alav HaShalom, in this week's parsha, in his book, The Weekly Mitzvah, on this week's parsha, actually talks about it in his book. I'm not trying to sell his book right now, but it's a wonderful book called The Weekly Mitzvah, in which he talks about halachas of every week of the parsha. And in this volume, in the parsha this week, my father refers to this question and really discusses whether or not there is a mitzvah to speak Hebrew. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. He actually speaks about whether or not the Hebrew has its own important status by itself, or is it just recognized as a mitzvah because it is a tool for speaking Hebrew. In a similar way, there is a tshuva of the Rav Yaakov Emdin, one of the great rabbis of Germany, who discusses whether or not it is permitted to learn Hebrew in the toilet. You know, they say the Gra used to learn math sitting on the toilet in the bathroom. That's what they say. There's like an urban legend about it. I don't know how true it is. But apparently, the Rav Yaakov Emdin was concerned about reading Hebrew in the bathroom, and whether or not it would be thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Right, I'm just saying that it's an urban legend. I think that's fair to say that. But Rav Emdin actually writes about this, whether or not it's permitted to take Hebrew literature in the bathroom. And what's interesting is that he was not concerned about the Hebrew language per se, meaning he wasn't bothered by taking Hebrew letters into the toilet. He didn't feel that Hebrew has kedusha in it by itself. What concerned him was that if you learn Hebrew, how can you learn Hebrew, he says, without quoting Bible, without quoting Jewish texts? And therefore, he was concerned that that would lead to people reading holy scriptures in the toilet, which is something that you should avoid doing. And therefore, he said you shouldn't do it. But he had no problem speaking Hebrew in the toilet from the language itself. And this is actually an interesting discussion. Is Hebrew really Lashon HaKodesh, right? And if it's Lashon HaKodesh, why is it called the holy sacred language? The Ramban and the Rambam actually discussed this. The Rishonim discussed what makes Hebrew special. Some argued that there's something unique and mystical in the language itself, right? And we know that many mystics discuss the meaning of the letters and what they mean. When God created the world, he created the world by speech, and the words themselves, according to many people, are what the world was created from. And in each creation of the world basically lies words and letters. However, others argued, no, let's not get mystical. What makes Hebrew special and different is HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke in that language. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in that language, not because it's a mystical matter, because that's the language that he uses, and that's the Torah that was written in Hebrew, and that's what makes Hebrew so special. This led, by the way, this issue led, as I'm sure you all are aware, to a very famous debate that in the early 20th century, whether or not we should speak Hebrew, even in Sichot Chulin, even when we just, you know, talk secular, you know, speech, meaning Jews throughout the generations spoke Hebrew when they learned Torah and when they prayed. But Jews adapted other languages and developed even their own language, like Yiddish and Ladino. But Hebrew was not a common modern speaking language up until the early 20th century. And we all have Eliezer ben Yehuda to thank for that. You know, many of my students think that Eliezer ben Yehuda invented the pubs and the bars of Jerusalem, because you probably remember that in Jerusalem, that's the name of the street where all the restaurants and bars in Jerusalem is Ben Yehuda. But actually, as we all know, thank you. I saw someone picked up the dictionary of Ben Yehuda. Ben Yehuda was a man on a mission. And he really succeeded in a remarkable way of introducing Hebrew as a modern language. And one man's battle, it's just incredible, by the way. I don't know so many examples in our history, and for that matter, maybe in world history, where one man achieved such a revolution. You know, Ben Yehuda was opposed by the religious circles. They saw him as the enemy number one. But until today, by the way, in some circles, he is considered the worst person ever, because they saw him as someone who is trying to... are you joking? Today is Ben Yehuda's yahrzeit? Oh my gosh. Wow. Wow, that gave me a shiver down my spine. Thank you. Wow. By the way, today maybe... today is tonight, or today was yesterday. I don't know. We have to figure that one out. But Eliezer ben Yehuda was the enemy because people in the religious circles they suspected that he had an agenda to change the Jewish tradition and to harm it by creating an alternative Judaism and uprooting Yiddish and all the and it became such a thing. I even have on my table here, by the way, the book Vayola Moshe. This is the book of the Satmar Rebbe that opposed Zionism in a radical way. And there's a whole article here. I actually haven't read it yet. I want to read it. But this discussion made me look into it. He has a mimer called Ma'amar Lashon HaKodesh. And he was opposed ideologically Jews speaking Hebrew. Right, he thought that they should speak Yiddish. And till today, there are those who oppose Ben Yehuda. Of course, the irony is that all those who oppose Ben Yehuda in Israel today, they write their opposition in Hebrew, right? Which is the biggest irony. And Ben Yehuda won big time. Because even in the Haredi communities today, 99% all speak Hebrew. So it's pretty amazing that this actually worked. However, I want to point out that in my research, I found a wonderful article. I actually photocopied it. There's no book like this. You can only find it on Hebrewbooks.org. It's a book called Safa LaNe'emanim, a language for those who are loyal, right? Written by the Torah Tmima. Written by Baruch Levi Epstein, who was the son of Rav Michal Epstein, Yechiel Michal Epstein, who was the Aruch HaShulchan. The Torah Tmima was a great, great Tamid Chacham. By the way, he was a banker. And on his free time, he wrote his commentary. He learned in the famous yeshiva of Volozhin. And what's also famous about him is that he was the nephew of the Netziv. And the Netziv actually married his sister, right? The Netziv married his own niece, which meant that after he was in the beginning his nephew, and then he was his brother-in-law. And he published, besides his different writings that he published, he also published memoirs of Volozhin Yeshiva. And they were translated into English. An art school book came out years ago called My Uncle the Netziv. And it was given out at some Aguda convention. One of the people and took it home and read that in the book it says, amongst other stories, that the Netziv of Volozhin read newspapers on Shabbat. And that created a big uproar in the Haredi community, which led to the book being put in Cherem and taken off the shelves. Anyway, of course, when I heard that story, I ran to get the book and I read it. And I always think that the best way to sell a book is to excommunicate it. And any book that's excommunicated always sells well. Years ago, I had the privilege of having a relationship with Rabbi Sachs when I was even younger, when I lived in England. And at the time, 20 years ago, one of his books created some kind of controversial issue in the Jewish community. I remember I was in his office and I said, Rabbi Sachs, you're so lucky. Now you like the Rambam and the Ramchal, your books are going to sell like hotcakes. Once people are going to say that your book has heresy in it, ooh, that's it. The book will sell well. So then the Torah Tmima of Rabbi Baruch Levi Epstein was a very interesting person. And he wrote a booklet in which he argued for the language of Hebrew. In 1893, a little bit before Ben Yehuda, this great rabbi, who was already pushing his own agenda, why it's important to speak Hebrew. So I find this very interesting, by the way, for other reasons, because I won't take away Ben Yehuda's credit, but it's important to remember that even before Ben Yehuda, there were those in the rabbinical community who were pushing speaking the Hebrew language. So to conclude, what we learned until now, we learned that the Jews in Egypt kept certain behaviors that have to do more with external culture behaviors that kept them going as a Jewish people. And for that, the Midrash really tells them, says how wonderful it was that they behaved in such a way. Now, at this point, I want to go back to the parsha. And I want to ask a question. And my question is a very, very simple question, which I assume people could stream out the answer. However, I want to learn this question using this midrash. And my question is, what was the merit, not of the Jewish people, but of Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was chosen in this parsha to lead the Jewish people and take them out of Egypt? This parsha, it really talks a lot about the story of Moshe. We know about his family. We know about his history. By the way, if you think about it, we do not know as much. We don't know anything about Avram Avinu, right, before he was an older man, for example, right? Unlike Avram, who just appears to us out of nowhere, we know everything about the birth of Moshe. We know about his childhood. We know about what he does. What was his merit? And I would like to argue that this midrash perhaps can be used to understand who Moshe Rabbeinu is. Because I'm going to try to argue right now that while the Jews in Egypt kept all these attributes, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't keep any of them. Okay, let's go through the list. We said the first one was Shelo Shinu Et Shmam. Let's talk a little bit about the name Moshe. What is the name Moshe and what does it mean? I'm going to go back to the wonderful article that I mentioned before of the Torah Tmima, Safala Ne'emani. In this article, he says, of course, a person should learn Hebrew. Hebrew is a very important language. And he says, if you don't understand Hebrew, you won't understand so many phrases and concepts that are mentioned in the Torah. Because how will you understand that the word Adam and Adama are the same, and Ish and Isha are the same, if you don't understand Hebrew? You can't translate these words and assume that it'll all be lost in translation, right? The Hebrew words of what they mean and where they come from. However, what example does he bring from this week's parsha? You won't understand Ki min hamayim mishitiu. Why is Moshe called Moshe? Because he is taken out of the water. To be taken out of the water in Hebrew, the verb is limshot, to pull out of the water. And he says, the Torah Tmima, you will, if you translate that, if you do not know Hebrew, if you don't understand Hebrew, it'll be lost on you. You won't understand why Moshe is called Moshe. And then he has a footnote. And I was so pleased to see this footnote, because he says, wait a second. What are you going to tell me now? You're going to tell me that Moshe is a Hebrew word and that it only can be understood by knowing Hebrew? But who named him Moshe? The daughter of Paro. And then he says, it's really remarkable. I wish I could translate his footnote here, because he says, oh, you think that Bat Paro spoke Hebrew? Nonsense. There's no way in the world that Bat Paro could speak Hebrew. By the way, I always like to make fun and say that according to the rules of Hebrew, Moshe should be called Nimshe, right? He was taken out. Moshe is the one who takes out, but he was Nimshe or Mashui, right? That would be the correct Hebrew way of calling him. So maybe as a joke, you can say that proved that she didn't speak Hebrew so well, because she made an error here in her vocabulary in pronouncing Hebrew the right way. But nevertheless, the Torah Tmima says impossible that Bat Paro spoke Hebrew. And if that's true, it must be that she used a word that's very similar to Hebrew language. So that would prove that you don't have to know Hebrew. Maybe just, you know, we can use the same words in different languages. However, he points out, and this is fascinating, because he points out that he read some German article, some rabbi in Germany, that a scholar in Germany, and by the way, on your source sheet, I also brought it down, in the name of the Netziv. which again, if you remember, I just said that Torah Tmima was the brother-in-law of the Netziv, and both in their commentaries mention the same person, Shmuel, who, I'll go back to the source sheet, who mentions this idea. Just 1 second, please. Go up to the source sheet. Here we are. Source number 6. They both then mention, Ra'iti b'shem harav Shmuel, dinat bohim. I'm sure Rabbi Kamen will help me out here where that is. I think it's some German, but I'm not sure. The Bilashon Mitzri, in old Egyptian
Bohemia.
Language.
Most Bohemia, likely Bohemia.
That's what I thought. I thought it was Bohemia, okay? The Bilashon Mitzri, it means Yeled. An old Egyptian, Moses, Moshe means boy. V'zeu bi'ur nachon. Now, I always like to tell people that, you know, if some scholar would say this, people would say, oh, that's heresy, right? But the Netziv and the Torah, we must say it, that's okay. They say that Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro, probably did not speak Hebrew. And when she named him Moshe, she saw him being delivered from the water. Okay? He was like born from the water. So she called him in old Egyptian, Moses, which means in old Egyptian, boy. Which, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, fits very nicely with another famous Egyptian called Ramses, right? Which is two words, Moses, son, and Ra, I think, is son with a U, right? So the son of the sun. So you see that Moses, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, I'm not Egyptian, but come from Egyptian. And the Torah says, I was so happy to see this explanation because it fits in beautifully what I'm saying, that really there is a play of words here, but the Torah meant that Moshe is Moshe because he is the redeemer of the Jewish people. He will take the people out of Egypt. But when she called it, she used an Egyptian name. So if that's really true, what we're saying here, and I think it's a beautiful idea that as if the Baruch Hu is telling us that when she called him the name, she when she calls him that name, she meant one thing. And in the Hebrew language, we can see that the deeper meaning of what she did is reflecting Moshe's goal in the future to redeem, to be the one who will take the people out of Egypt. He'll be the Moshe. He'll take people out. So I think it's a beautiful play with words and very beautiful. But if all that is true, Moshe is not a Jewish name. Moshe is based upon an Egyptian name. So going back to what we said, number one, if we said that Jews were known for their Egyptian names, for their Jewish names, Moshe is not a Jewish name, it's an Egyptian name. Let's continue. Let's go back to the source sheet. In the source sheet, we see here that, let's go up a little bit. Here, on source number 3, when after Moshe helps the daughters of Yitro, they come back to the dad, and they say to him, oh, this Ish Mitzri, but Pamarna, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu Miyad Haroim. An Egyptian man helped us with our sheep. Now, the question, of course, is why did they call him an Egyptian man? And the answer is obvious, because he was dressed as an Egyptian. And he probably spoke like an Egyptian. All those of you who saw the movie The Prince of Egypt, and I highly recommend to see it, because I think that when you watch that movie, you can really understand that Moshe was brought up in a palace of an Egyptian palace. It makes a lot of sense why the Torah is referring to him as an Ish Mitzri. And by the way, Chazal even rebuke Moshe for wearing Egyptian clothes. In source number 4, there is a very, very disturbing midrash that compares Yosef to Moshe and asks, why is it that unlike Moshe, Yosef was buried in Israel? what was the merit of Yosef that his bones were carried through the desert and brought to the land of Israel, while Moshe was buried outside of Israel? And the Midrash, and this is a very, I would say, a very disturbing kind of rebuke against Moshe, says, because unlike Moshe, when Yosef was in Egypt, he was in jail in Egypt, he was a slave in Egypt, he said, Ish Ivriani, right? He said, I am a Hebrew man. He identified himself as a Jew. While with Moshe, it says, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu Miyad Haroim. The Midrash says, Moshe did not identify himself as a Jew. And the proof is that in the eyes of the people of Midian, he was looked as an Egyptian. He was considered an Egyptian by his clothes and by his language. This is a sharp rebuke of Chazal against Moshe dressing up and behaving as an Egyptian. And if that's true, then we can now go back to that Midrash and say, whoa, Moshe has an Egyptian name, he wears Egyptian clothes, he speaks Egyptian. By the way, Moshe Bichlal had probably some kind of speech defect. I'm not sure how well he spoke any language, according to what the Torah tells us. So his language was a bit disturbed. His clothes were Egyptian. His name was Egyptian. What else is left? What else is left is, in matters of tzniut, well, they didn't marry out, it says. Well, Moshe married out. He married the daughter of a priest in Midian. And finally, and this I find amazing, in this week's parsha, and I didn't bring this on the sheet, but I'm sure when you get to the parsha this week in Shul, and you will read that when Moshe argues with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, God, don't send me, send someone else. I don't want to go to Egypt. And God says to him, no, Moshe, you're going to go. And they go back and forth and argue. At some point, Moshe says, God, Bnei Yisrael are not going to listen to me. They're not going to hear me. They're not going to. God says, Moshe, take your staff, throw it on the ground, and it will become a snake. Put your hand in your shirt, and it'll come out with leprosy. And Rashi points out, why is the staff of Moshe turning into a snake? Why is Moshe's arms full of tzara'at, of leprosy? Because Moshe just spoke Lashon Hara. Moshe spoke ill against the Jewish people. And we all know that the punishment for Lashon Hara is leprosy. That's a Midrash that Rashi quotes. So if we go back to the Midrash, there are four strikes against Moshe. Maybe what the Midrash is there's a twist in this Midrash. Perhaps this Midrash is not so much talking about the merit of the Jewish people as much as it is talking against Moshe. Moshe doesn't have anything of those qualities that we mentioned in the Midrash. He doesn't have a Jewish name. He wears Egyptian clothes. He speaks Egyptian language. He speaks Lashon Hara. And therefore, when you read this Midrash after this parsha, you ask yourself, what was Moshe's merit that made him choosing? He didn't even see himself as a Jewish person in any way. That, of course, I think highlights the answer that we all understand, which is that because of Moshe's background, because Moshe didn't have any identity as a Jew, it just strengthens the idea that Moshe did not have to become Jewish. The fact that Moshe, with all what we just said now, decides to cross the lines and to be part of the Jewish people just proves the greatness of Moshe. That from a person who was not considered to be Jewish, he wasn't born in the Jewish community, he wasn't identified, he was royalty, he spoke Egyptian, he had a good degree, he had everything going for him. He had no reason to turn his back to the Egyptian people. He could have stayed very comfortably in the palace and forget the fact that on paper he was born to Jewish parents. Dafka, this midrash, I think, proves the greatness of Moshe. And that is why Moshe becomes the greatest leader of the Jewish people, because the price that he paid for joining the Jewish people was so great, and he had nothing to lose to become Jewish, that it shows that Moshe Rabbeinu identified himself with the Jewish people in such an extreme way, and that was his greatest merit. And I think that if you go through the parsha and you see the stages of Moshe helping, aiding the Jewish people in their in the slaves of Egypt, and he helps them and he fights against the Egyptians, that just shows the greatness of Moshe. And I think that, and perhaps I'm suggesting that this midrash was written not only about the merit of the Jewish people, but the deeper twist of this midrash is to show us the great merit of Moshe, that although he did not possess these qualities, he still, lamotako, nevertheless, decided to switch over and become a Jew. By the way, there are stories like that throughout Jewish history, where there were people that, you know, didn't have to, had nothing. Someone just mentioned Herzl, but there were people that were totally assimilated in the non-Jewish world, and something triggered their identity, and against all odds and against any rational reasoning, they decided to identify themselves as Jews, even when they paid such a price. It's almost like, you know, the only thing I can compare Moshe and Mitzrayim coming out and saying I'm Jewish would be like a person who in during the Holocaust, right, who was born to Jewish parents and could hide and you know, stay as if not Jewish, and yet decide to come out and declare I'm Jewish. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu did in Egypt, and this midrash I think just proves it. So that was what I wanted to discuss today. We have, I think, 2-3 minutes for questions if anybody wants, or comments, Vakasha.
Thank you very much. Okay, anybody? The comments, I think you saw as you went along, if you look in the chat box. I don't really think there are really any questions. Just, of course, they would borrow Egyptian words. It's interesting. I started reading Leon Kass's book on Shmot. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it just came out, but, you know, he's a perfect example. You know, I've mentioned this book before, Umbrashid. Are you aware of it? Are you familiar with this book?
No, Leon? No.
So Leon Kass is a professor at University of Chicago. He must be in his 80s these days. And, he's a brilliant person, totally, totally secular Jew, totally assimilated, totally secular until a number of years ago, whatever. He was at a conference. Somebody got him onto Bible, and he fell in love with the Chumash. And he spent years and years and years studying Bereshit. And he wrote a book 15, 18 years ago on Bereshit. Then eventually he taught in University of Chicago, very insightful. And he just wrote this, and he writes in his introduction, I just started reading it this week. The book just came out. About Shmot. This is the work of, you know, the end, the later years of his life, you know, he writes, because he's not, he doesn't have a yeshiva background, but he's clearly very learned. He quoted the Netziv. He quoted about Moshe, meaning son. That's he talked about exactly what you were talking about. And he talks about Moshe not knowing who he is. Is Moshe a Jew or an Egyptian? And it's not even clear when he goes out and the Torah says, it's not even clear he knows. When he saves the Egyptian attacking the Jew, it's not clear from the text that he's doing it because he's Jewish or he's doing it because of a sense of humanity, morality, that there's a master beating a slave, not necessarily an Egyptian beating a Jew. The Torah tells us in Egypt, but we don't know what Moshe thought. And he develops that whole thing that Moshe himself was conflicted. Is he an Egyptian or a Jew? So I thought that very much, I just started reading the first, 50 pages or so, but very interesting.
By the way, I heard once a very interesting insight that Moshe also was an adopted child, and you can sometimes when people are adopted, they have this kind of tension of trying to find out who they really are, and that may be also true about Moshe.
They see he points out, Leon Kass points out, the Torah, it's true, unlike Avram, it tells us, you know, his upbringing, but it doesn't tell us what kind of education he got. And he's saying the Torah purposely left that out. Most likely, he got an Egyptian, went to an Egyptian elite prep school, you know, where he learned astronomy and mummification and, you know, and, you know, all the scientific beliefs of the ancient Egypt. And he was very, you know, got an Egyptian education. The question, you know, how much did he know of his Jewish identity? It's very fascinating. But of course, only someone who grows up in the palace, you know, he didn't have a slave mentality, as we all know. So different. All right. Anybody else? Please. I just, anybody have any questions, comments? Please throw them in. You can take a look, Rav Aviyat, at the chat box.
Yeah. Okay.
And by the way, the Rav did ride the subway.
Thank you for that. That's great.
I assume he went on the subway to go to Mariah, maybe, to give his shiur on Tuesday night. The Rev used to come to Mariah and they gave a shiur every Tuesday night in the Mariah Synagogue, I think, in the Upper West Side. And this is before my time, so I don't know. Your father would have known, of course. He probably went for all I know. But anyways, yeah. Oh, to YU. Yeah, but he was living in YU. The Rev was living in YU, so I'm not sure where he traveled. Like, he came from Boston. He took a train, maybe from the airport. I don't know. Maybe they didn't pick him up in those days. Yeah, people. I don't know. It's very interesting. Okay. I want to thank everybody. Thank you, Rav Tabori. I hope you're not too tired. 4:30 in the morning. Yeah, you're up. You're up for the, it's almost Shabbos already. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Tomorrow morning. Shabbat Shalom. 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. My shiur on the Siddur. Everybody's invited. And then we continue Sunday morning. Rabbi Liebtag. Rabbi Tabori's neighbor in Alon Shvut at 11:15 on Sunday morning. We like Alon Shvut. We got lots of speakers from Shuli Mishkin, Alex Israel. We got the whole Benny Gesundheit. We got a whole chevra from Alon Shvut. You know, this is one of the intellectual centers, especially for Anglos, if I could say, in Israel. As Rimon spoke, we also had a Hebrew shiur. Rav Bazak gave a couple Hebrew shiur. You can tell me a few names I'm missing. You know, we haven't had Rav Lichtenstein yet, but okay, maybe one day, Rav Moshe, but we'll see. Okay, everybody be well. Have a wonderful night. Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. And we hope to see you soon. Learning and invite a friend. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.